Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Financial Confessions with someone who I'm comfortable at this point referring to as a friend of the financial diet. But before I introduce you guys to her, I want to give a quick hello to our beloved partners with whom we create every episode of the Financial Confessions. So as you guys already know by now, every episode of the Financial Confessions is made in partnership with Intuit, who are the makers of so many fantastic apps that totally transform your financial life. Everything from doing your taxes to managing your personal budget to managing business expenses, if you have them, are made so much easier by having the right tools in your back pocket. And Intuit essentially pairs you up with the tools that you need to make all of these decisions more clear and easy to understand, help you reach your goals better, send you the reminders that you need to keep track of things. Because honestly, managing money can feel very overwhelming, and it feels really nice to have the right tools in your corner to help make sure you're doing things the right way and you're not forgetting stuff. One of the first things I ever did to get good with money was download Mint to my phone. And this was like in the time of my life where I was literally avoiding looking at my bank account because I knew nothing good awaited me there. And just having that ease of understanding my own finances totally transformed my life. Basically overnight, and led me eventually to creating TFD. So if you want to get started with Intuit's amazing suite of products, check them out at the link in our description or the show notes. Friend of TFD, therapist, YouTuber, writer, good person, Katie Morton is in our studio today.
Hello, Katie.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Welcome back.
I know.
Yay. Everyone loved. If you guys missed it, Katie did a couple videos on our channel on my Tuesday show like a couple months back.
Yeah.
That were fantastic. And you guys loved them. And you guys have been asking... You guys have been asking a lot for a therapist on the show because that is one of the professions that we haven't had. We recently had on a divorce lawyer.
I saw that. So interesting. Good stuff.
Yeah, no, good stuff. But we want to have more people who look at the topic of money and the topic of life through their specific expertise and prism, yours being therapy. So we threw it out to you guys to ask all kinds of questions for Katie, but before she answers them, want to give a little bit of context to the kind of therapist you are and how you're qualified to give this advice?
Yeah, so I am a licensed marriage and family therapist in the state of California. And my specialties are actually eating disorders and self-injury, which really translates to everybody else, meaning that I do a lot of CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy and DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, which really means that I work on changing our faulty thoughts so that our behaviors are more in line with where we want to go in life. Does that make sense?
Totally. That's fascinating. So interesting combination. So how does, for example, how do eating disorders and self-injury fall under the category of family and relationship?
Nothing happens in a vacuum.
That's true.
And we're always in relationships. But that's kind of the misconception about a marriage and family therapist is they think, oh, it's only couples, it's only families. It really means that unlike other masters in psychology fields, like social work and licensed professional clinical counselor, psychologist, we focus on relationships with others and relationships with yourself.
That self-relationship.
It's a doozy.
A doozy to say the least. So you guys asked tons of questions. I'm not going to be able to get to all of them, but I'm going to do a lot of them. And let's just move quickly.
I'll do my best.
So actually, this one is a good one to start with because you specialize in people with eating disorders, and I think this would probably be an example of that. I have an emotional eating problem. How do I stop spending so much money on this habit?
Honestly, the best way is to recognize your triggers, which I know a lot of people think, oh, just stop eating so much. Just, you know, set a budget, stick to it. No, it's more of, it's emotional. It's actually related to how we're feeling and what we think about ourselves and food. And so for many of my clients, the triggers could be like a fight with a loved one. It could be a trauma from our past that has sparked like a flashback. Try to pay attention to when you binge eat or spend the most on, like, something that you told me last time we got together was you're working from a budget, you just don't know it yet. So you can go back and look at like your last statements, figure out which days you spent the most on food, and maybe consider keeping track of like how you're feeling every day so you can see when you're working towards maybe that kind of situation again.
Right.
because there are patterns to it, and everyone's going to be different. For some people, it's stress at work. Other people, it's relationship issues. Other people, it's a trauma from our past. Really, eating disorders are coping skills. So what are you trying to numb out with food? That's the real question. I know that's a lot, but that's the answer to really how to slowly stop spending so much on food. It's not black and white.
Right. Probably wouldn't be too hard to get. I mean, wouldn't be a bad thing to get a little therapy in there.
Yeah, therapy. And a dietitian can help too. They can let you know what's a right amount of food to eat. Like, what's a good portion? Oftentimes we have like a skewed view of it.
Nice. Yeah, we do. Advice for how to have difficult conversations with family members who are making bad money moves.
Ooh, yeah, that's hard.
That can be super difficult when it's your elders in a family.
Yes, if it's like a parent.
Yeah.
I think the best way is, first of all, journal about it. We have to get it all out. All the nasty, angry, whatever you want to say, it's okay to write that stuff out. You need to get it out of your body so you feel like, and then consider the bullet points of what you really want them to hear. Keep it minimal, 3 to 5 things. Like, that's the maximum amount of things you should try to get across. Then practice saying them out loud in front of a mirror to a spouse or a friend, and try to role play what you think they're going to say back. And do that a few times until we call it no emotional charge. It really means that you don't get heated or overwhelmed in the conversation so that you can stay level-headed. And then go do it. Pick a time that's not a super stressful time, like holidays are terrible, a birthday party is terrible. Pick, you know, just go to dinner or go over on your own, just a random occasion, and that's where, you know, when you should speak about it.
I feel like it's so important what you said about just keeping a very narrow focus on what you're trying to get across. Mm-hmm. And I think particularly that's important because not only is it easier to take in when it's a relatively manageable number of things or specific, but it's also a lot easier to kind of keep the focus where it needs to be, keep a person accountable, because when you have a whole litany of things, you can easily cherry pick one of them, kind of argue it out, and like maybe whether it's, you know, whataboutism or it's making false equivalencies, it's very easy with a huge litany of things for the person to feel very overwhelmed, defensive, and find ways to poke holes in it.
Totally. Or just shut down.
Totally.
Or they don't even hear you. And I think that's the biggest problem when we try to communicate a lot of things at once, is it just gets lost.
Yeah.
I mean, I even feel that way personally if someone's like, so today I need you to, and they just start, you know, if they were like, here's the 15 things I need you to do, after like 3 or 4, I'm like, my brain just checks out, kind of. So keep that in mind. And I think practicing it really helps too, because we don't want to be overly emotional. That's when we'll say things we don't mean, we'll take things personally. Just in keeping it to what really needs to get across so they actually hear you.
I agree. We were talking before we started filming. I go to therapy once a week, and I find the most effective sessions individually are when we work on one very specific thing, and I, like to your point, will practice what I want to say about something, and just even say it out loud. We role play sometimes a conversation that I'm a little nervous about having, and obviously it's easier to do that with a therapist, but it is still something that you can do with a trusted loved one who is not part of the situation, like maybe a spouse or a best friend who's not necessarily involved with this parent situation, but could be a sounding board and tell you how things are coming across. Because ultimately, a lot of it just comes down to how clear and composed you're able to be in the moment. Yes. And how compassionate you can be. Because let's be honest, confronting someone about a bad money habit is not that different from confronting them about something else, like perhaps a substance problem or a behavioral problem, where it is so easy for that conversation to become incredibly defensive.
Totally, because essentially you're looking out at them and saying, like, something that you're doing doesn't sit well with me.
Right.
And we have to do that in a very careful and cautious way so that they don't immediately shut down and stop listening or leave the conversation.
Which is, I mean, an understandable response on some level. It's terrifying to be called out.
Yeah, it's hard.
Oh, this is terrible. I'm in therapy, but I have severe depression. How can I hold a job when it feels pointless?
Ooh, yeah. I was recording something the other day, and I love analogies. And I feel like depression is like falling into like a deep ocean, and you're like slowly falling down and you can't see the light anymore. It's slowly, like, you know, as you get deeper and deeper. Honestly, when it comes to this situation, I'm not a doctor, but I would recommend you see one. I would see a psychiatrist.
A medical doctor.
Yes. A psychiatrist would be my preference if that's not available, if that's too expensive. Even just a regular, your GP, like
an
your
internist.
Yeah, your internist, your primary care doctor. Get in to see them and let them know, because psychotropic medication, meaning antidepressant or in that realm, can really help us when we're drowning in the symptoms.
Right.
Therapy can't help with that, because therapy, in order for therapy to work, we have to be feeling good enough to be able to do some of the tools and techniques and new behaviors. We have to be able to challenge thoughts. If we are deep in that ocean and there is no light and all we can think are nasty, hopeless, terrible things, we're going to need some chemical assistance to get us. I always call it like a life raft. It gets our head above water, and it doesn't mean you have to be on it forever. Talk to the doctor, tell them all your symptoms, start writing those down. I know that can be hard. Have a friend help you if you're feeling really down and out. Like something I would have you write down, here's just like five things. How often are you showering? Write that down, tell them. How often do you have thoughts of suicide? Has your appetite changed? Has your sleep patterns changed? And do you have any body aches? Those are things they're going to look for. Write this stuff down and bring it in. And then ask about side effects. You don't have to stay on the medication forever, but really it sounds like you need a life raft, and that's okay. I know it's hard.
I just want to reach out and hug that person, but I know that wouldn't help.
But it does get better.
Well, yes, that's very true. It's interesting. I'm sure you've probably been through this too. Have you ever had like a flu? And as you come out of the flu and you're like going back to work and living your normal life, but like you have no appetite, mm-hmm. you're fatigued all the time.
Yeah.
You don't want to do anything. Like it's for people who've never experienced something like depression, it's very akin to that feeling of like everything feels like an unnecessary endeavor and nothing feels like it's so strange. Like the appetite thing in particular is so disorienting, that feeling of like food holds no interest.
Yeah.
You don't, it's, yeah, it's
everything is effort.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Fatigue alone will kill people. Like that is just, fatigue is so terrible.
It is. And it makes, I think that's why showering, like hygiene is hard, because that is a lot. If we're feeling super exhausted and overwhelmed, the thought of having to shower and then get ready again is just like, ugh, I'm already tired.
I don't think this applies to someone who's in a severe depression, but for people who are, for in the times when I've been in really bad kind of dynamics, I've found that if I can make myself shower, if I can make myself put on makeup, straighten my hair, and dress in nice clothes, all of a sudden I feel so much more motivated to do different things.
Yeah, I always tell my patients, if I can get you to shower and get out of the house for 15 minutes, you've won. Those are our goals to start out with.
It's mind-boggling how much easier it is once you're out to stay out,
mm-hmm.
or once you're dressed to go out.
It's just hard to get out.
Yes.
Yeah, or get dressed, right? That always makes us want to slump back on the couch.
Totally. What resources are available for people who want or need help but live in a therapy desert?
Ooh, there's a lot of them, actually. That's the cool thing about the internet. So first of all, if you're in crisis, if you're having a really tough time, there's Crisis Text Line. You can reach out to them. They have trained crisis counselors available. There's 7 Cups of Tea. I think it's just 7, the number 7. cups.com. They have like a peer support area, and then they have, you can pay to talk to a therapist through that. There's also BetterHelp is an online therapy where you can either text, chat on their site, or do like Skype sessions with a therapist in your area, or in your state rather. And then there's also Talkspace, I believe, is the other one that's similar to BetterHelp online therapy. And I'm sure there's others out there, but those are the ones that I'm the most familiar with.
Great. Yeah. Well, we actually had a question piggybacking on that about online therapy specifically. Is online therapy really safe and secure?
It should be. It's okay to ask to see their credentials, see their license, to get their resume or CV, whatever you want to call it. You can ask for that from a therapist. But as long as you're going through a reputable company, read through their terms of service. I know that sounds terrible. But read through like some of the, you know, things you have to say. I agree. I accept. Read through that. Make sure that it all sounds good to you. I know Talkspace and BetterHelp both have been super helpful for my viewers and my even members of my family and my friends. So I do believe they're credible and good. I prefer in-person therapy only because I think there's certain things you miss being online. Like, for instance, if you haven't showered or dressed up, you could look nice from here up, but if you're in my office, I know that you, you know, I can tell how you're doing. Or if you're fidgeting, your feet are shaking, it's hard for you to sit still. If I'm only seeing you from the neck up, I might not be able to tell that. So there's some things that can be missed, but I think online therapy is super, you know, it's great. It's a great resource. And yes, they, in order to be like credentialed, they have to abide by certain laws and regulations, but just check, always check.
I have a question about your style as a therapist. This is my question. Yes. I'm jumping in. So I love a therapist who's like extremely austere, very distant. Like my therapist is one of those therapists who like, if you're not talking, he'll sit there until you say something.
Me too.
That's your way? Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I feel like you give off such a vibe of being like a talker.
But it's different because that's like the channel, right? If I didn't talk, nothing would happen.
That's true. That's true. But it's so interesting. The things that people, I include myself obviously in the statement, mm-hmm. will say when they are forced with a silence and not being prompted.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Like, I've had several sessions where I go in and I'm like, well, I hate to disappoint you, but I really have nothing to say. And he's like, and he'll just sit there. And then I'm like, fine, fuck it. Like, and I go into it. It's so funny.
I might be a little more directive than that. Like, because patients always come in and I'm like, well, I don't really know what to say this week. And I'll be like, well, tell me what happened. Like, I'll just start off with something basic. Like, what happened yesterday? How was your day today? But if they don't talk, like, if I ask a question or two and there's no response, then I just sit there with them.
You're like, this is your money, not mine.
well, it's like, if you don't want, because there's a thing about in therapy where, like, we're not supposed to work harder than our patients.
Right, right.
But I'm also not supposed to work less hard, right? So I come to the session with the tips and tools and techniques and education to assist you in the best way I can. So that's my job. Mm. But if you're not meeting me there and trying to integrate the new information that we're learning together, it's hard. I don't expect it to be like, presto, fixo. Right. But if you're not even attempting,
right.
I'm not going to attempt either.
Yeah.
So it can be uncomfortable for people.
Yeah, and the therapy that you do is very, because you're talking to people who have, in many cases, like an immediate self-harming or endangering behavior. It's very behavior driven what you do, right?
Yes.
So it's a lot about like, you know, how did we do on this specific homework. Task this week?
Yes, there's lots of homework, lots of directives.
Right.
So it's a very compassionate but tough love type style that I do, mainly because I have to challenge the faulty beliefs that are creating this issue, meaning I'm not worthy, I'm not lovable, I'll never be enough, things like that.
Yeah. Gosh, that has got to be overwhelming at times.
I don't really see it that way. I don't
know.
It's
your job.
I know. I don't know. I'm like, it's weird because people are like, how do you do that and not bring it home with you? And I'm like, training?
Yeah.
I really don't know. It's just boundaries. I think it's actually healthy boundaries and my own therapy.
Love that. We stan a therapist in therapy.
Got to practice what I preach.
This person says, how do you balance charging what you're worth with helping those who need it most?
Ooh.
Sliding scale
always.
But
the funny thing is, just for complete candor, because I have no problem talking about money,
hell yeah,
I haven't raised my rates in a long time, mainly because it's not my full source of income.
What do you charge per hour, will you say?
$150.
That's what I pay,
and I feel like that's reasonable. It pays for my rent and I still am able to make some money after taxes, but a lot of my colleagues charge $225. And that's about the going rate in Santa Monica where I practice. So I don't raise my rates. I will if I have to. If when our rent goes up, I'll raise it like $5 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I also always leave two slots open for freebies, meaning I may charge them nothing. I may charge them. I always charge something. I will be honest, because I think you need to have a little skin in the game. You need to be at least. Otherwise, it's like, I don't know. If you get free things, we don't place as much value on it.
We don't care as much for them.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why copays exist, by the way, if people don't know that. And so I do charge at least $20. But, I mean, I have a patient now that's paying $60. Most of my patients are paying full amounts. And I have a patient that right now isn't paying anything, but she has in the past, but she lost her job. Mm. So, and I do stuff on YouTube. It's free education. So I think it's a lot of balance.
Good for you. And for those of you out there, never be afraid to be honest with your therapist about what you can pay, because my therapist was like, I go from $150 to $250 an hour. Obviously prefer to be the full pay. And I was like, Full disclosure, I love him. He's wonderful. Big part of my life. But he is in a very rich neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I know all the rich people who are going to this man. I'm like, I'm paying $150. That's what I can afford.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay. And it's been great. So if I had not said that, I don't think I wouldn't have paid $250. I just wouldn't have worked with him and I would have missed out on what has been a very beneficial relationship.
And that's the thing. It's okay to ask, do you work on a sliding scale?
Right.
That's language that they understand. They'll let you know. Yep. Everybody does. But they might say no if all their slots of that are filled, because we have to pay our rent and we have to
totally
do all sorts of things too, you know, we have to live our lives, but always ask for that. And a funny thing about it being a therapist is my patients with the most money complain the most about paying $150.
That's terrible. Really?
But yes. And I'm sure any other profession out there that has to gets charged, you know, charged by the hour, you'll feel the same way. You're probably nodding your head being like, oh my god, because I had this patient for many years. I'm not seeing her anymore. She has successfully launched, but her family was really struggling financially, and her mom did not want for me to give them a discount. She was like, I really respect what you do. I told her I only charged $100 because I could just sense that it was hard, and they always paid me every week. Even the grandma came and paid 1 week. I mean, it was like a whole joint effort to help their oldest daughter. But then, like, one of my patients who's a plastic surgeon complains every week. But that's what we talk about. It's not really about that. It's about, you know, something else.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah. Just for some inside scoop.
Also, just like how rude and awkward to complain every week about this service that you pay for and have like agreed to with a professional. Like, I hate that. Now, that being said, when we're setting the terms, I'm very much like, I'm like, it's $150. And I understand if that doesn't work for you. But once you agree to that, how dare you complain about it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't like that.
People do, but they come to therapy for a reason. So, yeah, work on it.
Not me. I'm perfect. I just go to polish the diamond.
I like that. That's funny.
Oh, man. This is a really interesting one. How can I forgive my parents for mishandling money when I was a child?
Ooh. A lot of what we have to do as adults, unfortunately, is grieve for what we wished our parents had done in many ways. I wish my mom stood up to my dad more, or my dad was better with money, or had saved for my college education, or saved for anything. There's a ton of, or abuse, and there's all sorts of other issues we could really get into. But when it comes to financial decisions and what we wish our parents did, you just have to grieve. Part of, I think we talk about grief when it comes to someone passing away, but we grieve all the time. What we thought this relationship would be when we all of a sudden realize that our parents don't know everything and aren't good at everything. I feel like that happens usually like in our late teens, early 20s, when you're like, or I'm 36, so I'm like, wow, my parents really had no idea what they were doing, because like I don't have any idea what I'm doing in some, you know,
sure.
Like you're just trying to figure it out. And so I think that that's really the key to that is accepting the loss and then letting yourself express that loss. And that doesn't mean that you have to tell them. I actually wouldn't encourage you to talk to them about it, because it's not going to get you anywhere.
Right.
What's done is done. But how do we move forward? So let it go. Maybe write a letter to your past self about all the things you wish you could have done, or you wish they would have done for you, or what that financial stability would have given you, or I don't know, whatever. Because I know that in a lot of ways, for children growing up with parents that aren't good with money, it can be traumatizing. Like, the lights are turned off, there's no food in the kitchen. So it's okay to tap into that young you and talk to them.
Totally.
Because in some ways we have to like reparent ourselves in the way that we wish it had happened.
And I would, I agree with all of that. And I would add, like, it's so important to remember that financial literacy is something very few people receive. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of backgrounds that can lead to people being in a very disadvantaged place with money, whether you're an immigrant or you're caught in a cycle of poverty, or, you know, you had an unexpected illness. Like, there are so many things that even people with the best intentions can be put in horrible financial dynamics. And even amongst people who are doing okay, real true financial literacy is something many people, most people even, don't have.
Yeah.
So
people don't want to talk about it.
People don't want to talk about it. So I feel like at least putting it in the prism in your mind of like, you know, I don't know if this person's parents were financially insecure, but understanding how difficult it is when you are in a cycle of poverty to get out of that cycle of poverty. And, you know, just having empathy for how difficult money is for so many people.
Yeah. And especially if we grew up not talking about it, or our parents, like if your parents' parents, like your grandparents, had their own weird behaviors around money,
right.
Like if we look to that, because we look to our caregivers, usually it's mom and dad, but it can be grandparents or aunts and uncles or whomever, but we look to those relationships and situations as blueprints for how we do things,
right?
And so if the way that your grandfather spent money was, you know, completely frivolous and out of control, you know, not that you can't still be sad about it, but it can make more sense as to why maybe your dad does that or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Patterns also help me feel like a little more empathy for situations where I'm like, wow, you didn't actually know any better. That's hard, you know?
Yeah. And I feel like that in that rule in general of like when people are behaving in a way that makes you upset, but often comes from a place of anger or hurt or defensiveness or, not handling some kind of injury well. Like, even if it's just a coping mechanism, I feel like saying to yourself, like, it must feel terrible to feel that way, mm-hmm. or to think that way. But for example, when you think about someone like who has, let's say, a compulsive spending issue, mm-hmm. which can be obviously devastating if that person is your provider, like, that is awful. But it must be awful to be in the brain of a compulsive spender.
Totally. And we know how out of control that can feel and how scary and unsure they can feel about their future.
Right.
We know that we've all been there in situations where we haven't made good money decisions, you know, or a lot of people have. And I feel like if you can just tap into that for a minute, you're like, they're not happy with it either. They just don't know how to fix it.
Yeah.
And having a little empathy and then giving yourself the time to grieve, I really think is like the best way out.
Yeah.
Versus the anger that I'm sure is being felt.
And can be felt.
But of course.
But ultimately, you know, if a parent or parents are severely mishandling money, they're hurting their child, but first and foremost, they're hurting themselves.
Yes.
You
know? And they had money problems before you were around, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, but it is hard, and it's okay to feel angry. It's okay to be upset. I was upset for years that my parents never saved for my college education.
Mm.
But it was mainly because they just didn't think about it.
Yeah.
What? You want to go to school? Oh. You know, which is fine. I'm thankful for it now because I appreciated school. I was serious when I was there. But, you know, but me being angry about it now isn't going to help that.
Right.
So I just have to understand that wasn't a priority for them.
Right.
And that they didn't understand how important it was going to be.
Right.
And I know now, because I've talked to my mom about it, you can talk to your parents too if you feel okay about it. But I talked to her about it, and she was like, she felt really guilty that they hadn't. And so, I'm sure your parent doesn't feel great about their decisions either.
How can I help my male partner disassociate his self-worth from his finances?
Ooh.
That toxic masculinity, boy. It'll get you every time.
It'll get you. Well, there's so much of how we perceive ourselves as rolled up into a lot of things. It can be money. It can be status, which kind of goes along with money, education, where you live. There's all sorts of things that we take on as like immediately judging ourselves.
Our bodies.
Yep. Yeah. That's the women problem, mostly men too, but it can really affect us. So I think part of it is just, and this sounds bad, but you can't make anybody do anything. They're like, how can I? You can help by giving compliments to things that don't have anything to do with that.
I was just thinking that. That's so true.
Because they're going to have to better understand their situation and why they're doing it.
Right.
Because like we talked about in our other videos, like mental health and spending, they're all entangled.
Yeah.
And so there's some reason that this person is doing this.
Right.
And so in order for them to understand that and to improve that for themselves, that they have to want to do it. You can't make them, unfortunately. No. But they're going to have to get in therapy or talk to a financial, you know, assistant to help them better understand what's going on. Watch more of your videos, better understand, you know, money and things like that.
Watch all my videos.
Put it on autoplay and just let it roll. So doing some of that so they can better understand. But the best thing you can do is just compliment other areas and encourage them to get support.
Yeah. I would also find things to do with that person that you guys really love and treasure that don't cost money.
Yeah, that'd be great. And like, doing things in general in your life, you're like, oh, well, we'll just stay in because I got this food. I'm going to cook this. And, you know, I got a bottle of wine so we don't have to go out. And all of those.
Picnic.
Yeah, money saving.
A tandem bike ride where you're both wearing berets and neck scarves.
Ooh, so romantic.
Just, you know, riding through the park.
I feel like we're like in Paris or something, but super cheesy.
Yes, baguettes and flowers sticking out of the baskets. Yes. Now, your self-worth is not dictated by your finances.
No.
But you got to take care of them.
Yes.
So as I mentioned earlier, basically the first ever step that I took in my life to get good with money was to download an app called Mint. It's totally free, by the way, which syncs up to all of your bank accounts and your credit cards and your credit score, everything that you need to get a full picture of your day-to-day personal finances and managing your budget. It will do things like make a really beautiful little pie chart of all of the different ways you're spending. You can set goals for spending targets in certain categories, and it will even literally send you little text messages letting you know when you're going over in a certain category and need to reel it in, which, let's be honest, happens kind of frequently with me in food. But basically, it just acts as this little buddy to help make sure your entire budget is being managed in the right way and you're working toward your goals. I have personally found it to be transformative in my own financial life, and I cannot recommend enough that you check it out at the link in our description or the show notes. That's Mint, a totally free app. Oh my God, this is funny. I feel like this question is so not framed well. Is it better to compulsively save or to compulsively spend? How about compulsively not do it?
Like, yeah. Nothing compulsive.
Nothing compulsive.
That's the answer.
Nothing should be compulsive.
No. Yeah. It's, yeah. But understanding, I think that it'd be helpful for this person to probably better understand their triggers.
Right. I mean, listen, if you're somehow deciding between the two as a life path, because usually you don't really have much of a choice in the matter. You do one or the other.
Yeah.
But let's say in this hypothetical scenario, you just literally are like, I could become a compulsive saver or a compulsive spender. I mean, listen, on some more financial level, sure, saving a ton of money is probably better.
Yes.
But we actually just heard from the person that I interviewed just before, Katie. He saves 99% of his income, and his biggest financial regret was spending a lot of his 20s saying no to almost everything to save every possible dime, and he regrets that.
Well, and that's the thing, because money in some ways is just a tool to have life experiences and grow.
Right.
There's obviously a line between that and compulsive spending, like overindulging in things, going above your budget and racking up credit card debt or things that can make it difficult for you later. But yeah, like it's okay to buy those concert tickets or to go out to that nice meal because you really like food and you like that place, you want to try it, and you enjoy experiences with people, conversation over, you know, there's things that you can do and there's ways to spend your money thoughtfully. It's not black and white. This compulsive thing sounds very black and white. I'm either doing this or I'm doing this. And I encourage you to embrace the gray.
I agree. How do you tell the difference between just being busy versus being productive at work?
I think in a lot of ways, it's, I always think to myself, is there a better way to do this?
Totally.
And if you check in and you're like, I don't know, doing something very tedious, that there's got to be a program that can do that for you.
Right.
Or, for me, I'm like, is this something that I could source out to someone else? But if that's not the case, it could be like, are you just distracting?
Right.
I feel like busy, I don't know why we romanticize that word.
Being I hate busy. It. I hate it. I hate the word busy. Drop it from your vocabulary.
Yes, and like hustle.
I'm so busy right now. Oh, hustle. Shut, please don't even
like,
get me started.
Shut up. Stop. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, also, I'm sorry. I know it's like supposed to be a humble brag, especially in New York, that you're busy. But if you're busy, that just means you can't manage your time well.
Exactly. Because we all have time.
Not like, a brag. Not a flex.
No. Some of my friends will say, back in the day when I was working two jobs and doing YouTube, like, it was chaos, I'll be honest.
Totally.
But a lot of my friends are like, I don't even know how you find the time. And I used to say, you always have time, it's just how you manage it.
Absolutely. I'm such a passive-aggressive bee. Like, when someone will be like, because I know a few people who are very, like, busy kind of fetishists.
Uh-huh.
And love to talk about how busy they are. And anytime someone would say, like, I've just been like so busy. I'm like, that's crazy. I have like so much free time. Like really any time that works for you works for me.
Yeah.
I can do whatever.
He's got to put it in my calendar.
Yeah. Just stick it in my calendar and I'll do it. I'll make time for it. Like just because the thing is that I think at the end of the day, people aspire to being busy for the sake of being busy because I think they think it's some sort of like character, you know, building exercise.
And we've been like supporting this forever. I feel like for the last maybe 10 years, there was this meme that I saw. Sometimes memes just really...
Love a meme.
Oh, they just hit a home so good. And it was saying, like, why does everything have to be a side hustle? Whatever happened to hobbies? Whatever happened to free time?
Totally.
And I'm butchering it because it's a meme, so it's much more hilarious. More pithy. And yes, and like, boop, drop that. So I really... But the overall gist of it is very true.
Totally.
Can't we just have free time? Can't we make time for friends and not have to take Instagram photos to prove it or share it or got to create that content? Hustle, hustle, rise and grind.
Yeah.
It's like, stop.
And at the times when I feel most busy, as in just like most overwhelmed with tasks, those are the times I'm least happy.
Same.
And I will say, this is probably one of those fake quotes that like, you know, when you see the like quote that it's like, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best, Marilyn Monroe. And it's like, no fucking way that woman said that. But so this is probably one of those like fake quotables. But someone, I think it was Bill Gates, said that he always gives the hardest tasks to the laziest person because they find the most effective way to do it.
Oh.
You know, the shortest way to get the job done. And I feel very much the same. Like at our office, like I really could not care less what time people come in, when they leave. Like it doesn't matter. Just look at the results.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you get completed what you need to get completed?
Totally. And if you can do it in a shorter span of time,
yeah,
great. And it's funny because like we did Summer Fridays last year. Loved it. We're going to do Summer Fridays again this year. And if productivity is the same, we're keeping them.
Well, yeah. Did you, there was a study. I think it was in Japan, where they took Fridays off.
Yeah, and productivity increases.
And they were more productive.
Yeah.
And I thought that was crazy. And that kind of reminds me, I love The Office. I don't know if you watch this.
Who doesn't?
It's so good. But Michael talking about Jim to the camera, he's like, I mean, he's not very good at things. I can spend a whole day on a project and he'll finish it in 20 minutes.
Yes, but that is exactly it. It's exactly it. And because like, I mean, the vast, vast majority of desk jobs, there's at least an hour or so every day where you're just like, doing whatever.
Yeah.
You know, shuffling papers around, reading.
Right. Reading your news on your phone or something.
On Twitter.
Right.
Pointing to myself. And I, you know what? Like, that's only because you feel some sort of existential obligation to just be sitting at your desk and being at work. But what is work? Like, well, it should just be the task at hand.
Agreed. And I think that's something that as entrepreneurs, I have to constantly check in with myself because I'm not a morning person.
Same. Oh my God. Wait. And you're like, guilt. I have such respect for you. And now you've validated a life choice that I'm not a morning person. Tell me more.
Yes. So I don't like to get up at like 7 and be to work at 8. That,
me either.
I don't work well at that time. I'm actually most productive between like noon and 4 p.m.
Yeah.
Those are like my crazy good hours, right? So I have, and I still struggle with it, but recently this year, If I don't set an alarm unless I have to, and I let myself wake up on my own, because I wake up between 8 and 9. That's just when I wake up, because I don't go to bed at like 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning, which is fine if you do. Everybody's different. But I'm trying to work with my brain instead of against it. And I think that this guilt that I have associated with, well, I need to work from 8 to 5 or 9 to 6. Did I put in enough hours? I'm exhausted by myself. Because we do creative work too. And if I do 2 hours of intense creative work, that's all my brain can do that day. And that's okay.
So it's
like permissions. It's okay. No guilt.
Yes. I'm so into this. I get up every day at 8:30 a.m. I take the 9:15 train. I walk all the way to the end of the train where I get a completely empty car because it's like past the morning commute hour and the front end of the train is always empty. My commute is so pleasant and so quiet. And I get to work just before 10 a.m., usually at 9:50 a.m. every day. Often the last person, but who cares? That's when I do my best work. And I leave at like 5:30 every day.
That's perfect.
It's the best life in the world. And the thing is that I have told people, like everyone in the office, I'm like, if you like to come in at 7 and leave at 3, have at it. If you want to come in at 10 and leave at 6, I don't care. Just like everyone should lean into what allows them to do their best work.
And that's the best thing because you're working with your brain instead of against it. Because
absolutely.
There are three types of cycles, and I'm sure there's other variations within it, but some people are morning people. They do their best work between like, let's say 5 a.m. and 8 a.m. or something. Mm-hmm. And then it's all downhill from there. So those people should be in the office at those times. Then there's people like us we're middle of the dayers, which arguably I think it does work to our advantage with regular jobs because we're already there. You know, we're at the office working during those times. And then there's night owls, people who do their best work between like 6 p.m. and midnight.
Yeah.
Or something. You know, there's these different waves. And I think instead of trying to squish like a square peg into a round hole, we should just say, hey, I work better at these times, so I'm going to do this way.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah. I used to be a true night owl, especially with writing.
Yes.
But it's just hard to like be in society.
That makes it really difficult to have like any real, in society, have relationships. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Engage with people.
You could have like, I have a friend that worked nights that I was friends with back when I lived in Paris, and he worked at a hotel in the overnight shift, and I was freelancing and doing most of my work at night. And like you kind of just inherently become unhinged. Like we'd meet for our morning coffee at like 4 p.m. and we'd be like, how are you? You know? And I'm like, okay, we're like officially kind of losing our minds. Shout out to Damien. I'm not sure where he is these days. All right. What is the toughest thing about being a therapist and how do you manage it?
The toughest, that's tricky. I think there's two. I'll give you two because there's like two sides to it. So the toughest thing is having a regular life, like going on vacations and stuff when you have patients is very difficult.
Oh, right.
Because you want to be there for them, but you also have to have healthy boundaries and have your own life. And so that balance of that I find to be very difficult and just tricky, you know? And also with that, I guess, like hearing people's horrible things that have happened to them can sometimes be hard. I've gotten better at like focusing on the good and like, I believe in the good in people, even though sometimes people can be total garbage. And so, yeah, so there's that component of it. But then there's the component of being a therapist and people assuming things about you because you're a therapist. Like, for instance, this is just a random, I was on a podcast, this is probably like 6 months ago. And the woman who has this podcast was on The Bachelorette, and she's also a therapist. Hmm. And people had a big problem with her being on The Bachelorette and being a therapist. Like, how dare you? You shouldn't. And she's like, what? I can't, first of all, want to make money. Second of all, want to find love. I'm in my late 20s, like, get out of my business. And I found that very interesting. And since I had that conversation with her, I've been noticing people's assumptions about me because, like, certain things that it's not okay. Like, for I got therapist. A tattoo, and people were like, a therapist with a tattoo?
Tell us about the tattoo.
Oh, it's my tree. It's my, back in the day, my little tree intro for my videos. It's like, doodly-doodly-doo. And I got it on my ribs over here. And it's because it changed my life, and I loved it, and I wanted it. And that's also just me as a person. Like, take it or leave it.
Rib tattoos are super painful.
I think not to say like, oh, I manage pain really well, because I feel like a lot of people say that, but I didn't think it was that bad, and everybody was like, that's the worst. I don't have a ton of tattoos. I really don't know.
I manage pain really badly.
Oh, so is my husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shout out to him. Different. I'm like, no thanks.
Yeah, you're like, ow, no.
Mm-mm. No.
But yes.
Double dose me up on the local anesthetics.
Yeah, right? Numb it up. Let's do it. So anyway, I think that those are the two most difficult things is like thinking a therapist is only one thing because everybody has, like when I say the word therapist, I'm sure people already put together a picture of what that would mean.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm like such a petty person. I'm like, I wanted my therapist to look like a therapist.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, and I get dressed, like I wear very business attire when I go to the office.
I would like that.
Always wear like closed-toed, high-heeled shoes. I don't know. It's just a thing.
Do your patients call you Katie or Dr. Morton?
Katie. Katie. Because I'm not a doctor.
Ah, yeah.
But I think they all call me Katie. Mrs. Morton sometimes, which is very strange. It makes me feel like I'm a teacher.
I'm very into the doctor, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I'm like, for me, it's like a nice boundary. I'm like, you're not a person. You're a doctor.
Which is fair. also paying for expertise. So you're like,
right.
Okay, doctor, you tell me, you prescribe to me what to do.
Like, I accidentally called him Matthew, and I was like, that's so deeply inappropriate. Sorry that I did that.
You felt like you'd crossed a boundary.
Yeah, it was weird. I was like, oh, no.
But you like it that way.
I like
that's
it.
That's what you kind of prefer.
Yeah, because I feel like, you know, everyone seeks a different thing out of therapy, right? I feel mm-hmm. like some people want, this is like wild speculation. You could tell me if this is totally off base, but I feel like some people who lack really stable, secure, loving, giving, empathetic relationships in their life, a lot of times what they really get out of a therapist is that kind of interaction,
yes.
is that kind of communication. And I just am very lucky that I have so many of those relationships in my life. I'm like, I got it up to here with like the empathetic, unconditional love. Mm-hmm. I'm here to work.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I'm very much, I'm in it for like the, you know, I want it to feel in some ways like an internist, like a doctor. You know what I'm saying?
And that's fair. I think that's why it's important to find a therapist that fits you.
Yeah.
I'm the same, by the way, in my therapy. I almost want like a drill sergeant.
Same.
To be like, stop messing this up.
Yeah.
I told you last time. You know, mine doesn't do that, by the way.
No,
because
that'd be rude.
We don't. It's really rude. But sometimes I want her to like call me on my shit.
Yeah.
You need to tell me.
Yeah.
And so that's what I want. But some people do need more of the... you know, unconditional positive regard, we call it in the therapy space. So it's like, I'm always like empathetic, understanding, you know, it's a holding environment.
I don't want that.
No.
I'm like, because yeah, I feel like you're similar. You want to feel like you're being challenged and maybe seen in a way that you normally don't let yourself be seen.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
I totally am with that. But I also feel like it's funny because I think a lot of people, when they think about therapy who have never been to therapy, I think they have an image of it that's very antiquated because it's often from like film and TV or from like things from a long time ago or like Freudian therapy, like all that kind of stuff. And I think people don't realize that there's now just such a wide spectrum available of the types of therapy you can seek and the types, even within those types, the type of therapist you can have.
Yeah.
And I want to shout out, you have a couple videos that describe all the differences of the types of therapists, mm-hmm. the types of therapy, and like what might be right for you. Highly recommend checking them out.
Yeah, because there's so many acronyms that we use in the therapy world,
right.
And nobody knows what those mean.
Right.
Like when I said CBT and DBT, I'm sure some people were like, CBT, that sounds familiar.
That like weed oil?
Right?
That's CBD.
CBD. But that's the thing, is there's too many acronyms in our world. And
there
so,
are.
Yeah. So I decode that and talk about that. And yeah, I'm glad I found that helpful.
Yeah. It taught me that a psychiatrist is often most beneficial for people who are looking, for example, to take medication.
Yes.
Which I'm like, I'm not, I of course support medication for those who need it, but I personally like to, when I've taken medication in the past, it's been for sleep.
Yes.
And I really did not like that experience at all. So now I'm like, I want to do everything I can to change my life so as to not take medication.
Yeah. Yeah. And you should try things first.
Totally.
Because I feel like medication isn't needed for everyone. And if you can do the work in therapy and try to sort out what's keeping you up,
yes.
then maybe we can do it without, you know, but it's there if you need it. It's a life.
There if you need it. I agree. How do you handle budget conversations as a couple with very different emotions and very different net worths?
I think when it comes to relationships and money, it's important that we have ongoing conversations as things shift. Mm. And I think when it, I mean, you can chime in on this too, because I really think that complete candor about spending habits and how much you make and stuff, like if you're living together, if your finances are entangled, then you need to be able to talk about it in a real way.
Right.
And I know that that's really uncomfortable, especially in the era, like, I feel like, I don't know if it's the era of this, but it's probably been going on since I was a kid, but like, I don't tell them I did this and I have my own monies that I hide away to be able to buy. Like, you just need to be honest about it, because there's no shame in spending money on jeans if you wanted them, or going out to a fancy meal. Like, you're going to have to communicate about it in a real way.
Right.
And if you have, like, I have a friend who has this, where she doesn't make very much money and her husband makes a lot of money. And they've had some struggles with it because of the power dynamic associated mm-hmm. with that, and her decision to want to go on vacation and him being like, I'm not paying for that. And so I really
don't like that language.
No. And I really think that what has to happen is you have to be honest about what you're making mm-hmm. and what your spend is every month, and what you're both comfortable with when it comes to budgeting for vacations,
right,
clothing, dinners out. And then you stick to that budget, because as long as you've agreed on it and your money's entangled together, then it's like you're making decisions together to spend it this way.
Right.
And then if you are having issues, kind of like my friend was having, where I'm not going to pay for that and I'm not doing that, then you need to be in therapy, because there's a bigger issue going on here, where it's more about the money equals something different than money. It's a power move. It's a control thing. And I would, as a therapist, I'd be very interested to understand what is making them feel out of control that they need to try to take that back.
Right.
Or what do they feel like they don't have control over in the relationship? Or do they not feel like they have any power in the relationship? How are you talking to one another? I mean, I could really get into it because then that's like, then that's in my wheelhouse. It's like relationship talk and stuff like that.
Yeah. I totally agree with all of that. I think number one, the person who has the financial upper hand needs to go out of their way at every turn to counteract that inherent power imbalance. Mm-hmm. It needs to be an active thing. If you ever feel that your partner's higher net worth or higher income is a point of leverage, of shame, of guilt, of control, that's an enormous red flag. We've done several videos on that.
It's a terrible toxic relationship.
It's incredibly toxic. And there should never be a dynamic in which the person who earns more money expects from you more, for example, domestic tasks.
Oh, yes.
That is extremely important because ultimately the person who does what task domestically, you both live there. You mm-hmm. both it's dirty shared. Dishes. You both wear clothes. You both mess up the bed. Like, you can't suddenly say that because the person earns less money, they're also de facto the domestic, you know, person, particularly when that person also works a full-time job.
That's the thing. If you have more hours, you're at home more, you could pick up more, but that shouldn't be this tit for tat.
No, and it should be a very clear collective decision that you're making as a couple about the division of labor. But oftentimes that's not the case, and it's oftentimes very easy to slip into a dynamic mm-hmm. of, I have more money, therefore it is my call. I always have separate accounts with some fun money. Even if you're both earning the exact same amount, you should have money outside of your joint accounts. You should have money that is just for you to do with as you please. That is not subject to committee. That you can feel good about.
You don't have to
about.
Ask for permission.
Because honestly, like, not every purchase should have to go through your partner. And also, like, not every, like, your partner doesn't want to sign off on every dumb purchase you're making.
They don't need to know that you wanted a new pair of socks.
No.
You bought new earrings. That's not necessary.
I don't need to know. Like, Mark loves, I've mentioned this before, but he loves buying board games, reading all the instructions, opening it up, like setting up all the pieces, assembling it, thinking about it, and then putting it away and never playing. he'll occasionally, like once a year, he'll play it with someone, but like he very much just like loves having a lot of board games. And
that's okay.
God bless him.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be a part of those decisions.
You don't need to know.
And I don't need to know.
That's like Sean with camera equipment and guitar stuff.
There you go.
I'm like, no, I don't need to know about it.
No. And like, or me and throw pillows.
Same.
Love a throw. I have that throw pillow, that green one from West Elm. I have it.
It totally switches the whole look of a room.
It changes everything. But Mark's like, oh, yay. I like another ugly allergen, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know. No, he likes my throw pillows. But in any case, he would never buy them. And exactly. I don't want to put him in the position of feeling like he has to authorize.
And what about this one or this one or this one? $60. You think that's too much?
It's like, honey, people. I don't have an opinion on the throw pillows. So anyway, suffice to say, it's funny. Like if I'm ever out for a week on the video, the comments will be like, did Chelsea drown in her throw pillows finally? But all that to say, you need to have some independence. But when it comes to a joint account, and this is maybe a less universal, more sort of my own opinion, but I think mm-hmm. that anytime when you have a joint account, money that goes into that joint account or in those joint investments or what have you, that is automatically as much your partner. Well, I mean, legally, it's automatically as much your partner's as it is yours, unless you have some kind of prenup going on. But ethically, philosophically, it should be shared. So if you are feeding into that account, even if your husband is putting in 10 grand and you 2 grand every month or vice versa, that 12 grand is both of yours equally.
Yeah, it's your family money.
Yeah.
That's the way Sean and I look at it, is like, it's our money. It's not mine versus his. And I feel like the less language we can create in a relationship of mine versus his or hers, the better.
Totally.
It's just dividing you more.
The worst moments that I've ever had with my husband about money have been when we got territorial about contributions to things.
Yes.
And we always then the next day will come back and be like, I'm sorry. Like,
same with Sean and I. When we were dating, not married, we lived together, we would do this end of the month tally of who owed who what. It was horrible.
That sucks.
But we didn't want to mingle money together. We honestly just stopped doing it.
Yeah.
And we were so much happier.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, some people, they want to go their whole lives and they get, you know, the prenup that supports this, but they want to go their whole lives with totally separate finances.
I know.
And that's your choice. And if both of you are really into that and down with it, you have every right to make it. And if it works for you. But I think for most people, that feeling is such an easier route to resentment and judgment and counting pennies.
And one of the main issues, and I wrote about this in my book, but I do it with couples all the time, is no laundry listing. You can't keep a list of I did this, they did that.
Totally.
You did it. You know, you can't, like, that's just not going to work. That's only going to cause more issues and more fights.
Right.
And the same goes with money. You can't count your pennies and hope, you know, you and think that it's going to, then you're going to feel happy and healthy with them later. Like, it becomes a weird dynamic. It becomes like a business talk, not a relationship conversation.
Yeah. It doesn't come from like enough empathy. But although I will say, it happened recently. Mark got me a gift that I was like, oh no, like, you, this was way too much. Like, I don't want this. You know what I'm saying? And like, I was like a little nervous at first. It's like, oh, he got this really nice gift. He's really excited to give it to me. But our finances are shared. And I was like, I would rather put that money elsewhere. Like, I don't. And, but once you have that really like open, honest communication about money, I, in a different time in my life, I would have just like bit my tongue and been like, okay, I guess I have this thing now instead of the money that I would rather have.
Yeah.
But I was very like candid and I was like, I just, for me, that's too much for this item. And I don't feel comfortable, you know, with our money being spent that way. And to his credit, he was very like cool about it and very understanding. But if we did not have a very open, very empathetic relationship around money and our money and what we want to do with it, I never would have felt empowered to say that.
Yeah. You would have felt like you just had to deal with it. But it's good to speak up and it's good to talk about it more because now he knows that too.
Totally.
Like, it's a learning too. Otherwise, you could have been setting yourself up for years of that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I know multiple women who have received engagement rings that were ludicrously expensive. I have a girlfriend, I'll never name her, of course, but her engagement ring was $16,000. And she was not a part of that financial decision. They weren't even engaged, obviously, at that time when he purchased that. But she was like, I would have rather we put that toward his student loans.
Oh, he has to, oh no.
Massive
oh,
student
no.
loans.
Oh, oh.
So
no.
I know, and I was like, girl, like, you have got to say something.
And
like,
right away, the sooner the better.
The sooner the better. Like, you just can't. But that's such a particular and touchy thing. Like, they juice men up about it.
They do, as if it really matters. It, like, some ego. Like, it shows how much they love you, or it shows how much they make.
Oh, my God.
It's
all
ridiculous.
The numbers that people throw out there, like, it should be 3 months of your salary. Who is paying that money for that?
Right? And, yeah. But it is interesting because I had a friend too that her boyfriend, they're now married, but her boyfriend at the time had bought her a huge Prada purse.
Oh no.
And he couldn't afford it, but we didn't know this at the time. And then for Christmas, he got her like the wallet, the matching wallet for it. And she had said something like, I don't know what even brought it up, but she learned that he had put both of those on a credit card and he was going to make payments on it. And she promptly was like, where did you get these? I need to return it then. We need to take this wallet back. Like, I don't need this. But I was like, you need to talk about it right away.
Totally.
Because if that's his idea of how money can be spent and what's okay.
Totally.
And then you need to
You're getting a lot of Prada bags.
Yeah. And potentially secret credit card or something.
Oh my God. The conversation with Mark about this gift is, I was like, because first and foremost, I was like, this seems like a little over the top for me. But, you know, I was trying it on. I was like, you know, I'm going to be a good sport, whatever. And I was like, you have to tell me how much you spent on this. And he told me. And I was like, oh, hell no. Hell no. We are going back to the store right now, this minute. I was like itching. I was like, get this out of my house. Like, we could do so much other stuff with that money.
Yeah, with that money.
Yeah. But they really juice men up that the gifts and the jewelry and all that stuff is like immediately, like how much they love
you. It plays into that power role of like men have to make more money. They have to spend more money. They have to like laugh, you know, but.
No.
Gifts are not everyone's love language.
No.
They're not mine. It's not mine.
Gifts, I mean, I like a gift, but I would so much rather that an equivalent amount of money be spent on a trip, for example.
Oh, same, because shared activities, that's my
love
language.
Love a shared activity. My love language is acts of service, I'm not going to lie.
That's my number one.
Ah!
And then shared activities.
Oh my God, twins. Okay. I always make like a stupid noise. So it is our rapid fire question.
Ooh.
We've come to that time.
Okay.
So get ready to get honest about your money life.
Okay. That's fine. I like that noise, by the way.
What is the big financial secret of your industry, being psychology?
Ooh, financial secret. That's a hard rapid fire question. I think, that therapists make a lot of money, 'cause we actually don't.
What's like the average income?
$55,000.
What? What about for psychologists?
60,000, I believe. What? And the numbers change every year, and I'm not up to date on 2019 even. This is like 2018 or 2017 is the last time I looked. But yeah, I didn't actually get my doctorate because it didn't mean that I would make that much more and I would spend that much more in education.
Holy crap. What? My therapist charges $150 to $250 an hour. Where's that money going? He's a psychologist.
Taxes. Think of like all the things, your overhead costs of office and health insurance and things. And private practice can make more, but then when you take vacation, you don't make money.
Mm.
So, you know, and that's averages too, right?
Like, right.
I'm in Santa Monica, you're in New York. Those are both super wealthy areas. I'm sure therapists are making more, but the average is still like, yeah, not very much.
I've seen the kind of clothes he wears. I think he's doing better.
He might be doing better. Hey, some people are business people too. They're better at it, but they don't teach us that in school.
Yeah, no.
And they should.
He does get a, he has a splashy office though, I'd say. It's nice. Has a wall of books. Feels trustworthy. What do you invest in versus what are you cheap about?
I invest in furniture.
Oh, interesting. Nice.
I invest in travel. I like trips. I don't know if that's like an investment, but
no,
I see it's an investment. And things I'm really frugal about are, so many things. Like I clothing.
Mm.
I get it on eBay.
Mm.
Or this is Rent the Runway.
So we had a lot of Rent the Runway in here.
Well, they had a good deal for Black Friday, so
Ooh.
I did like 3 months a discount, and then I promptly canceled it and set a reminder so that I don't get charged a full amount.
Whoa, we love scamming the system here at TFG to save ourselves a little money.
Yeah, because they think they're going to make money off of my laziness or my forgetting, and that's
Once that trial's done, so is Katie Morton.
Exactly.
What has been your best investment and why?
My best investment is actually, I don't know, there's a couple. So I invested in our couch. I know it's furniture, but it's a couch.
And how much was your couch?
$2,000.
Whoa, where's it from?
Crate and Barrel or West Elm?
Nice.
I think West Elm. Anyway, nice. I love it. It's comfortable. It's the size we wanted. It's the shape we wanted. We live on it. It's amazing.
Nice.
I also invested... well, I bought a purse, and I didn't invest is a strong word when it comes to purses for me, because I know relative to other people, this is not very much, but I spent $150 on it.
I'm going to like out myself as being flashy, but I feel like that's not expensive.
It's not much, but I got it on eBay and it's a nice brand and it has lasted years.
What is the brand?
It's Rebecca Minkoff.
Nice. My husband's friend's wife is like a purse buyer for Rebecca Minkoff. Like she were a purse seller, whatever. She was like, apparently I've got the purse hookup now. I'm very excited because her bags are really cute.
They're really cute. They're simple. They go with everything. I like it. And these shoes, actually.
Minkoff?
Rag and Bone. But I got them on eBay again. That's just me. I'm a pretty frugal person.
I love that.
But it was a good investment. $150. That's a lot for shoes. For me. I'm super cheap.
I love that. Loud, I'm like, that's great.
I like a good deal.
What has been your biggest money mistake and why?
Ooh, student loans.
People either say that was their best investment or their biggest money mistake.
I could have gone to community college. I mean, the experience is worth, but I shouldn't have. I came out of school with close to 100. Yes, and I was on scholarship. So in undergrad, I only paid $16,000 a year. Opposed to, if you guys don't realize, it was $36,000 a year when I went in, and it was $44,000 when I left. And then graduate school, so I left all of schools with scholarships. I applied to every scholarship. I did as much as I could to be budget friendly, but almost $100,000 in debt.
Oh my God.
So don't do it.
Don't do it.
It's not worth it.
What is your biggest current money insecurity?
I mean, I don't know how to, I don't know if this is answering the question properly, but just the future, because YouTube is so, and we'd like to buy a home because of where we live. It's very expensive to buy any kind of property. I'm sure you understand in New York. And so I'm like hoping that things continue to grow so that we can do that.
Nice. What has been the financial habit that has helped you the most? It's got to be like frugality.
I guess, yeah. It's my love of a good deal.
Love that.
I don't mind hunting for a good item and waiting for it to go on sale.
Only a fool pays retail.
Yeah, I think so too. I just got a really nice, this is my actually a splurge item too on eBay. I just because I rent the Runway one and loved it so much. I was like, I'm going to buy my own. I'm going to wait. And all the winter stuff is was on sale in summer and vice versa, summer and winter, you know. So I buy things out of season. I got this long wool Vince jacket for $200.
Wow.
That's like a $700 jacket. And it's, I've gotten so many compliments. Whenever I wear it, people are like, where'd you get that? And I'm like, eBay.
I love that. And last question, when did you first feel successful, quote unquote, and what does that word mean to you?
Oh God, I don't know if I felt that way. Maybe writing a book. I think when the book came out, that felt very like surreal.
Holding a book is a big moment.
Yeah, like I created this. Like I don't have children, but I like birthed it from my brain.
We're both, for those listening, we're both doing the birth canal gesture at the same time. It's true. It's so true. Well, thank you, Katie. It has been a pleasure. We always love to have you on TFD. You're always welcome.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Where can people find more of you?
Just Katie Morton, KatiMorton. I have a YouTube channel. I've got social media and I have a book. Are You Okay? A Guide to Caring for Your Mental Health.
Love that. No E on Katie.
Oh, no.
K-A-T-I.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Correct. Well, thank you guys. And we will see you next Monday. Bye. So we talked a lot about how to manage the bigger picture moments of your life today. And one of the things that you will want anytime you are going into a bigger picture moment with your money is to have that next level view of your financial health. Obviously, Mint is amazing for managing all of your day-to-day finances and your budget and that kind of thing, your spending in various categories, what have you. But ultimately, your finances should serve toward bigger goals for when you're going to do things like maybe take out a loan or buy a home or make a very large purchase, and you're going to want that more nuanced view of your financial health. So a great companion app to Mint is an app called Turbo, which is also totally free, made by Intuit. And basically, Turbo gives you that next level look at all of the various indicators of your financial health, things like your net worth, your debt to income ratio, your credit utilization ratio, your credit score, and all of the various details you'll need to know in order to improve those metrics so that you're more credit worthy, you can get better rates on lending, and you're just generally in a really healthy financial place. Once you've mastered the day-to-day habits and spending, you'll want to level up. And Turbo is the app that allows you to do it, and it's totally free. So check out Turbo at the link in our description or the show notes to get started today.